Hey, good evening, guys. How are you? Is it just me, or have the clouds really been spectacular this week? I'm just blown away. Every time I drive, even the fog looked nice. What is that about? Oh, this is fun. I almost hope the Mayans are right, you know? Get out of here and go home. Well, we have been studying and reading through passages in the Gospels, especially in Luke here for several weeks, you know, that really aren't very warm and fuzzy. You know, as I go through these and I'm studying and I'm looking, you know, at the passion of Christ and the trials of Christ and the problems that he encountered, especially in these last days, we don't always pull out the most comforting messages. But a lot of times what we can do is pull out reassurance by the hurt and the pain that we see in Jesus's life and in the things he underwent. And we are reminded what he purchased for us. And that is a warm, fuzzy thing. You know, we spent last week in the Garden of Gethsemane and in the courtyard of Caiaphas the high priest. And we were witness to the betrayal of Judas. We witnessed the agonized confusion of Peter. As he started out, he thought he knew what he was doing and lopped off Malchus's ear. And then Jesus said, stop. And he got confused. He got so confused and so discombobulated that when it really came time to stand up and say something for Jesus, he was not able to. That's a little scary. To be honest, I think that's something that could happen to any of us. You know, if you get ambushed suddenly, you know, if you see it coming and you got time to kind of screw up your courage and your faith, it's not as difficult. But I know where I have trouble. It's when I get socially ambushed, you know, out of nowhere, and all of a sudden I have to talk to somebody in the mall or something, and the situation is weird. And that's what I want to talk about tonight. Those kind of trials, I think, are a lesson we can pull out of the trials that Jesus was subjected to. And I'm going to look at those. You know, I'm looking through the various Gospels, and each of them kind of has a different order in which these things happen. Some guys list as many as six different trials. You know, one is by Annas, one is by the guards, one is by the Sanhedrin together, one is by the Sanhedrin first, then the Sanhedrin together, and then Pilate, and then Herod. And it can get pretty confusing. But what we do know is that when Jesus was arrested in the garden, he got drug off to the high priest's house, and it seems that he was subjected to an unofficial trial. It's kind of like before they took him to the official trial the next morning at the temple, at the Sanhedrin, it's like they wanted to make sure they had the evidence they needed. They wanted to get their story straight. So when they came before the Sanhedrin, and more importantly, when they came before Pilate, everybody's story was the same, and they could nail Jesus, literally and figuratively. That's what they wanted. And kind of that's what I went with. There's a lot wrong with this trial, both the official one and the unofficial one. For one, it's held at night, and I hope you know that Jewish law absolutely forbade that. The verdict was returned within 24 hours, which was, again, a violation of God's law and the Levitical codes. There was no defense offered of Jesus. The verdict came in one day. It was held at the priest's home. I mean, that was just, even the unofficial trial wasn't supposed to be held there. And also, at the end, Caiaphas himself was the first to render a verdict, which is just the opposite. The high priest was supposed to be the last one to speak. All the other priests were supposed to render what they thought their verdict would be. And this thing stunk to high heaven right from the get-go, and all of them knew it. They were worried. They didn't feel good about it. They cut every corner they could. They were upset. Even their behavior, their anger testifies to their knowledge and conviction that, wow, we're messing this up. But it's like they couldn't let go of it. They had to keep going. Well, it's now early morning on the day of preparation for Passover. It's Friday, and the morning is dawning. And there are just a few more preliminaries before the Sanhedrin convenes for the official trial of Jesus. If you turn to Luke 22, we're going to start in verse 63 for the preliminaries. at which now the men who were holding Jesus in custody were mocking him as they beat him. And that word for beat, that's not slapping. That's not just a little. The word means to thrash or to skin. It's what you do to a dead animal that you've caught on a hunt. And you're tenderizing the meat. That's what they're doing to Jesus. This isn't a light going over. These are the police, the temple police, that really worked for Caiaphas. They also blindfolded him and kept asking him, "Prophesy, who is it that struck you?" And they'd whack him again. They said many other things against him, blaspheming him. What's very interesting, if you want the grisly details, you'll have to go to one of the other Gospels. Luke is kind of reticent about sharing the grisly details of this. Right? You remember last week, he didn't mention the kiss of Judas. Here, he doesn't talk about the spitting that the guards do on Jesus, which the other Gospels do share. Later, we're going to see that he omits completely the details of the flogging. I don't think Luke has a weak stomach. I think he just doesn't want to dwell on some of the ugly details of this. He feels like this is ugly enough. All I got to do is tell the story. People can read between the lines. It's really interesting, this last verse. And they said many other things against him, blaspheming. Can you imagine what those other things were if Luke didn't even want to mention them? It's going to be pretty ugly. Well, then we get started with the real first trial. When day came, verse 66, the assembly of the elders of the people gathered together, both chief priests and scribes, and they led him away to their council, probably in or near the temple. We're not exactly sure where they might have taken him at this hour, but it was near the temple. And they said, "If you are the Christ, tell us." But he said to them, "If I tell you, you will not believe. And if I ask you, you will not answer." Now, Jesus knows there's really no point. Through most of these trials and most of these interrogations, he really doesn't say a word. He just is quiet. He knows they've already made up their mind. He's not going to try and argue them out of it. Remember, he is still actually walking a tightrope balanced between being forgiven and let go and being condemned for actually being an inciter of riots and insurrection. I don't know if you guys remember when Peter strikes off Malchus's ear, Jesus is really quick to grab him and say, "Stop that. Otherwise, when I get arrested, I'll be guilty of starting a riot." Do you guys remember when Jesus was asking the Pharisees about where did the authority of John the Baptist come from? What was their answer? He knows they're going to do the same thing. He could pin them to the wall like a butterfly in a collection. But they're not going to answer, and he knows it. And he's content. He knows the real drama that's going on here, the real work that's being accomplished through these trials is happening whatever they say, whatever they do. Verse 69. Well, 68, "If I ask you, you will not answer. But from now on, the Son of Man shall be seated at the right hand of the power of God." Now, this is something interesting that I just discovered in studying this. It didn't occur to me. I really didn't remember, because we're so used to thinking of heaven filled with saints, and we're going to have a wonderful time, and there'll be little carts that people are pushing around filled with glazed donuts, and and that's just the beginning. But listen, for the Jews, there's nobody in heaven except God. When you die, you go to Sheol. You know, and it's not the same thing as hell, but it's not the same thing as heaven. In Isaiah chapter 6, when he has his vision, who's in heaven with God? The angels flying around him saying, "Holy, holy, holy." But there's not a bunch of Oregon Christians in sweatpants and sweatshirts hanging out, having a good time, whooping it up at the marriage feast. That's a completely new idea. The Jews didn't have any idea of that. So when Jesus says, "Well, no, I'm going to be sitting there with him. Next time you look, I'm going to be sitting on his right hand." That stunned them. That was like a slap in the face. That's why they ask him the very next verse, "So," they said, "are you the Son of God then?" And he said to them, "You say that I am." And you'll recall that is the name God gave to Moses when Moses asked, "What do you want me to tell the people? You know, who should I say sent me?" You tell them, "I am sent you." Jesus knows very well how he's answering this. And it's interesting. It would be very fun if he just came right out and said, "I'm God in the flesh. Worship and bow me, or I'll destroy this puny planet right now." That would make things much easier. But he doesn't do that. He just, boy, he really weaves a wide net that lets you fall through. If you don't want to believe, those holes are really big and you can fall through real easy. If you want to believe, there's plenty of stuff to grab onto in faith. But he doesn't make it easy for anybody. "You say that I am the Son of God." And verse 71, obviously they're convinced. Then they said, "Well, what further testimony do we even need? We've heard it ourselves from his own lips." And effectively, this ends the first trial of the before the Sanhedrin. They marched Jesus off towards the Antonia Fortress. It's really only about a quarter mile. It's just on the other side of the Temple Mount. Remember that the Romans built it there so they could keep an eye on the Jews. So when things got out of hand, the legion would be right there to rush into the Temple Mount, beat a few heads, and calm things down. You know, if you read the Gospel of Matthew, he actually fills us in at this point. As they're marching him away to the Antonia Fortress, this is when Judas shows up before the remaining chief priests, and he changed his mind, is what John says, which is the same word for repent, metanoia, bless you. I don't know exactly what that means. I'm sure it doesn't mean that he was saved. I think what it means is he was sorry it didn't turn out the way he wanted. Maybe he wanted Jesus to be shoved into a spot where he had to summon those angels he was talking about. Maybe he wanted Jesus to take over and kick the Romans out. We really are not given a look into Judas's heart. But whatever happened, he didn't expect this. He didn't expect Jesus just to go along and go with this whole thing. Now he's beginning to sense, oh, wow, Jesus really is in trouble. He's not going to fight him. They might kill him. I didn't want that. And he goes back, no, listen, our deal's off. And they laugh at him. They give him the 30 pieces of silver. And he throws it on the ground and he runs off. That poor guy. I mean, it's okay to feel sorry for him. We won't see him when we get home. We know that much. God is able to judge the heart of Judas, and we just have no clue what was really going on in there. What we do know is he then proceeds to go off and hang himself, and in the process, somehow his guts spew out. I don't know exactly how that works, but depending on the height he flings himself off of, we'll spare you the details of that particular thing. We move then into chapter 23, verse 1. Then the whole company of them arose, all of them, and brought him before Pilate. Now, Pilate is the procurator of Judea. He's a Roman governor. He is answerable directly to Caesar for the administration, the taxes, and the political stability of all of Judea. I'm not going to dwell on this except to say this is the sinkhole of the Roman Empire. If you work for Caesar, this is the last job you want. You'd rather go dig pirates out of the Greek caves on the Ionian Sea than go and be procurator of Judea. For one thing, you got to take care of those cranky Jews. And they riot every time you turn around. Doesn't matter if you slaughter 1,000 of them. They still keep rioting. But his job is to keep the peace, keep the taxes coming, and administer this territory for Caesar. So it's not a happy place. He's not in a happy place. Well, they bring Jesus before Pilate, and they begin to accuse him, saying, "We found this man misleading," means corrupting, distorting the nation. "We found this man misleading our nation and forbidding us to give tribute to Caesar, saying that he himself is Christ, a king." Anything wrong with that? That's exactly right. We know that he actually endorses paying taxes to Caesar. What does he say? Render unto Caesar that which is Caesar, after looking at a coin. You could look at a dollar bill to say and today and say, render unto Washington that which is Washington's. Never mind. Gosh, I didn't work very hard on that one, okay? You know what else? You remember when Peter and he were a little stymied because they were collecting taxes, and he told Peter just to go down and grab a fish off the shore? When you open that fish up, there'll be a stater, a coin. You can pay the tax for both of us. This is a bald-faced lie. These guys are lying out there. They're not even trying to tell the truth. I mean, they're not even making any attempt. This is just, we're making up whatever we can, whatever we need to get the conviction before Pilate that we need. And Pilate asked him, oh, by the way, any shutdown of taxes, Pilate would find that pretty threatening. That's not something Caesar would be really forgiving about. So verse 3, Pilate asked him, are you the king of the Jews? And Jesus answered, you have said so. You know, I wish Luke would go on. John actually relates a very lengthy conversation here. Remember where he's asking, you know, about truth and the nature of the heavenly kingdom that Jesus is a king of. Luke doesn't tell us any about that. Although it is interesting that later when Jesus is crucified, having asked, are you the king of the Jews? And Jesus says, you have said so. That's exactly what Pilate writes on the sign that he puts on the top of the cross. He didn't have to do that. It was really not even in good taste to tease the Sanhedrin about that. You know, he was actually friends with Caiaphas. Did you guys know that? Pilate is the guy that appoints the high priest every year. And for Caiaphas to be appointed 10 years in a row means he and Pilate have a pretty good relationship. They get along really good. They see eye to eye. It's a relationship that works, you could say. So why would he do that? Another mystery. Verse 4, then Pilate said to the chief priests and the crowds, I find no guilt in this man. Very interesting word. It means cause, source of evil. I find no guilt in him. This is as prophetic a statement as you could possibly come up with. There is no guilt in Jesus. And Pilate is very aware of that. This actually reminds me of the prophetic statement of Caiaphas in John 11:50, where he says, without knowing what he's saying, no, it's actually expedient for one man to die for the nation. And we record that. It is a prophecy because that's exactly what Jesus is doing. I think Pilate's making the same kind of prophetic statement. There really is no guilt in this man. Well, when he says, I find no guilt in this man, the whole mess should have stopped right there. He's the procurator of the Roman Empire. It should have stopped right there. As soon as he said that, that should have been the end of it. But it's not. But they were urgent. I mean, they persisted. They kept saying, but he stirs up the people, teaching throughout all Judea, from Galilee even down here to this place. So what he's doing is they're describing to Pilate what a big threat Jesus is. He's not just a local boy. He's inciting riots all the way up to Galilee. You know, up into Herod's territory. And boy, Pilate jumps on that. Well, wait a minute. When Pilate heard this, he asked whether the man was a Galilean. And when he learned that he belonged to Herod's jurisdiction, he sent him over to Herod. And this would be Herod Antipas, who Herod was himself for Passover in Jerusalem at that time. How interesting. If you guys have never studied this, it's really confusing. One, it's really confusing to learn how Herod became king of the Jews anyway, and how did his sons inherit after he died. I'm not going to try and fill you in tonight. You'll have to take our history class at PBC. But it's very interesting. But what you do want to know, Herod Antipas, he's the one that beheaded John the Baptist. He's the one that married his brother's wife. Herod Antipas, he was given charge over Galilee. His other brother was Herod Philip, and remember, he had charge over Syria. up there around Mount Hermon in the north. Well, what you may not know is that their third brother, I think Herod killed a couple of their brothers, but the surviving brother, Archelaus, was in charge of Judea. But he was an incompetent idiot. I mean, just they rioted every 2 minutes. Caesar plucked him out. I don't know if he executed him or got rid of him or exiled him. I don't know. I should look it up. However, the replacement, instead of being the king, the Jewish king of Judea, Caesar just said, no, we're not messing with this anymore. You're out of here. I'll put one of my own guys in. There's no longer a king in Judea. There's a procurator. So this is all still pretty recent. But in Galilee, Herod Antipas is still doing a pretty good job of being king. So Caesar leaves him there. And when Pilate learns that he's come to visit for Passover, he says, oh, that's great. I'll just send Jesus over to him. This is actually a very sly gesture on his part. What he's doing is he is really offering a gesture of respect to Herod. He's saying, look, you know more about all this Jewish stuff than me. I don't really know if this Jesus guy is guilty or not. You would know better than me. Why don't you check this out? Verse 8, when Herod saw Jesus, he was exceedingly glad, for he had long desired to see him, because he'd heard about him and was hoping to see some signs. The word does mean signs, marks, miracles, some sign done by him. Well, Jesus' response isn't much of a surprise if you remember what he had to teach about the desire to see signs. Anybody remember that? An evil and adulterous generation wishes for a sign, but the only one they'll get is the sign of Jonah. People that want signs, well, you know, they really don't want the essence. They don't want the steak. They want the sizzle. And the fact is, when they do get signs, they don't believe anyway. So you can about bet what Jesus responds here. Herod questions him at some length, but he made no answer, none. And the chief priests and the scribes stood by vehemently accusing him. They're worried Herod's going to release him, or they're worried that Jesus is actually going to do a miracle, please Herod, and get on his good side and escape. So they are really, they're on the sidelines in the peanut gallery, really shouting this down and reminding Herod what an evil guy Jesus is. But Jesus isn't talking with Herod. I'd love to know what they were saying. Well, you know, Herod gets tired of this. Verse 11, and Herod, with his soldiers, treated him with contempt, despising him, mocked him, and then arraying him in splendid clothing, he sent him back to Pilate. Didn't even bother with a verdict. The implied verdict, since he didn't execute him, is he's innocent. And that's, we're going to learn that that's how Pilate interprets this. You know something that's very interesting, though? Herod starts abusing him before the soldiers do. And I'm thinking back, Annas and Caiaphas start abusing Jesus before their soldiers do. You know, I saw a really interesting program on ethnic cleansing and genocide. One of the things that all of these things have in common, whatever the leaders begin to do, the people start picking up immediately. As soon as they see the boss doing it, doesn't matter. The Armenian massacre in Turkey in the early 1900s, the Jews in Germany, the Christians in the Sudan right now, in Darfur. If the people see their leaders mistreating another group of people, it's open season. The sin pops out and the pus runs. I'll tell you what, people are, it's just below the surface. You think we wouldn't do that here? We could see that here. Tell you what, if you see our government start really coming down on Christians, don't go back into the house. Flee into the mountains. I would think it would not take long if you saw real hurtful things, physical abuse of Christians beginning in this country by those in power and authority. Please don't think it's going to take a long time for that to happen to us. We may be closer than we know. or it could happen to someone else. If it happened to the Jews again, or even to the Muslims in this country, it would be our job to stand up and say something about that. It would be our job to protect them and say, this stinks. You guys can't do this. It's just something to be aware of. We lose track, guys, because we live in America, but man, you don't have to go very far away to find human beings torturing and hurting other human beings. You really don't. It's just a good reminder. Isn't this a warm and fuzzy message? I'm so glad I could share this with you guys. Something really interesting here. Verse 12. Herod and Pilate became friends with each other that very day. For before this, they had been at enmity with each other. Oh, that's fascinating. What a little hint. We have no idea. We have no idea why they were mad at each other, why they disliked each other, or why even this seemed to heal that breach. But from that day forward, they were buddies. Very, very interesting. Gosh, I can't wait to get home and go through God's entire DVD collection. I really, really will fill in a lot of blanks. Okay, Herod and Pilate became friends. 13, Pilate then called together the chief priests and the rulers and the people. And he said to them, you brought me this man as one who was misleading the people. But after examining him before you, behold, I did not find this man guilty of any of your charges against him. And neither did Herod, for he sent him back to us. Look, nothing deserving death has been done by him. I will therefore punish and release him. Now that word for punish is, actually punish is not even the best translation. It means to correct, to chasten, to discipline, with the hopes that he'll learn his lesson and do better. I will punish and release him. Now this is Herod's second try to get out of this. This is twice that the imperial procurator of Judea has made a pronouncement. But they're still not letting him get away with it. The other gospels actually make clear that Pilate sends Jesus off at this point to be flogged. I think Pilate did not intend it to be as severe a flogging as he got. They actually had three levels of flogging, and he got the worst one. He got the one that a criminal received before being crucified. And I don't know if the guards were listening to this or not, but that's what happened. He got the nasty version. There are also, in your King James, you might see now he was obliged to release to them at the feast one prisoner in verse 17. We're not certain that was in the original manuscript, but by all means, keep it there. It's just that Luke, that's not the sort of thing Luke would normally include, but it definitely turns out to be the case. Pilate says, I'll punish and release him. But in verse 18, they all together, all of them as a body, cried out, away with this man and release to us Barabbas. Now, Barabbas means son of the father. That's all it means. So they're asking for the wrong son. Barabbas was a man who'd been thrown into prison for an insurrection started in the city and for murder. And Pilate addressed them once more, desiring to release Jesus. You know, if we dissect this a little bit and if we can call in the support of the other gospels, what we find out, he is completely hip to the fact that the Sanhedrin, the Jewish leadership, are filled with envy. They want Jesus' popularity with the people. They want his spiritual power. They want all of the things that belong to him. They envy him. Well, Pilate's very aware of that. And not only that, do you remember the dream that his wife had? And she was shook up. She said, boy, don't you have anything to do with hurting this guy. I had a dream. You don't want to mess with this. I think God may have touched her heart and let her see what was coming down. Problem is, Pilate's looking at this. These guys are getting ready to riot. You know, they're making all kinds of accusations, again, as we see in the other Gospels. This guy's an insurrectionist. You know, he's telling us not to pay taxes. He's claiming to be a king. All of these things. If this gets back to Caesar, what happens to Pilate? Oh, he's on a short trip to nowhere. If you think this was a bad posting, wait till you see his next posting. Plus, he's terrified because this is a festival. Jerusalem is three times as packed as it normally is. And we got all these hillbillies out here. It's not just good, sophisticated Jewish city people. It's all kinds of wackos from all over the countryside. It's like a keg. It's like a powder keg that just needs a match to set it off. They're all in this pre-festival, pre-Passover frenzy. I can't run this risk. If I do anything wrong, if I say anything wrong, if I make the wrong decision, this thing explodes and Caesar will crush me like a bug. So he's terrified. I mean, he's putting up a good front, but I mean, he's already told him two times and he's going to tell him a third time. Once should be enough from the imperial governor of Judea, but they're ignoring him. They're just pushing on. The Jews always do this. Bless their hearts. Pilate addressed them once more, desiring to release Jesus. But they kept shouting, "Crucify him! Crucify him!" A third time he said to them, "Why? What evil has he done? I found in him no guilt deserving death. I will therefore punish and release him." It's an official declaration. The third time. They ignore it again. But they were urgent, demanding with loud cries. In the Greek, that is megas phones. I just want you guys to know that you know more Greek than you think. Megaphones. They demanded with loud cries that he should be crucified, and their voices prevailed. They overpowered Pilate. At this point, Luke doesn't record it, but in Matthew 27, we read that Pilate actually brings out the basin, washes his hands. He's disgusted, but he doesn't know what else to do. But he does want to communicate, this is not on me. This is on you guys. I wash my hands of this. And what's their response? Let his blood be upon us and upon our children. How's that working out for them, do you think? It's not working out. That just gives me the shivers up my spine that somebody would say that. So I'm thinking some of them actually even knew, but like Judas, boy, they just make, oof. Oh, the other thing they said, I think in Matthew, we have no king but Caesar. So Pilate decides that their demand should be granted. And in verse 25, he releases the man who'd been thrown into prison for insurrection and murder, for whom they asked, and he delivered Jesus over to their will. You know, one of the interesting things to note is that Barabbas is actually guilty of the charges that Jesus is being crucified for. Almost a symbol for each one of us. The guilty goes free, the innocent is crucified instead. Very interesting. You know, in looking through this, you know, in looking for what do we take away from this? We're looking at three trials, really, I mean, if you lump them together. Three trials with different motives, three different verdicts, and yet each of the outcomes is the same. It's the condemnation of Christ. Now, these guys aren't believers. One of the things I think we need to remember is that their motives, their verdicts, the temptations, the testing of Christ, this is something, what came to them actually comes to us. It still does. In our lives, in our walk with Christ, these things come to us. The first one, the trial before the Sanhedrin, motivated by greed. They wanted what belonged to him. They wanted the authority. They wanted the power. They wanted the popularity. They wanted all these things, and their verdict was guilty. He's guilty. Their desire to keep their wealth, position, and privilege secure and to have what Jesus deserved, and in fact, I mean, he already owned it. He is the Lord and the King of God's kingdom. I found myself wondering, you know, do I ever hold on to anything that actually belongs to the Lord? I'm very sad to tell you what answer I arrived at. Yeah, I do. Are there times when people make demands on me of my time, or maybe some of the things that I have, or maybe they're just needing help? You know, as a pastor, I get to see that a lot. You know, they just need a couple bucks, you know, they're running short of rent or something. Sometimes I sandbag that, and I think later, gosh, why'd I do that? You know, or even feel the Holy Spirit tugging at my heart, not all the time when I see the guys on the street corners say, well, work for food. But once in a while, I'll feel the Spirit touch my heart, and I know I'm supposed to go back and talk with that guy, and I don't do it. You know, I'm guilty of this. I do this. And that makes me feel badly. I really don't like that. It makes me feel like one of the guys in the Sanhedrin. I could easily do that. I could easily be motivated by greed and hold on to something that really belongs to him. You know, the trial before Herod, what was he motivated by? It wasn't greed. He had everything. He was motivated, I would say, by lust. He wanted to see the bells and the whistles. He wanted to see something exciting. He wanted to be gratified. And he wanted it right now. He couldn't wait when Jesus got pulled in there. He wants to see the fireworks. He wants MTV. I mean, he wants Netflix. He wants eye candy. He's lusting after it. And when Jesus just sits there not cooperating, well, he doesn't even give a verdict. His verdict is neutral. Just get out of my face. And so I thought about that. Do I ever do that? Do I ever compromise a value of God's kingdom based on my own enjoyment? And you know what? I do. I might be writing an article. I might be doing a sermon. Might be doing worship, doing up a worship set. And because it's so neat and clean and tidy to do it this way, and it gives me pleasure, I'll actually ignore what the Spirit's telling me. Well, but the three lessons won't all start with the letter P if I do that. I've done it. I know I've done it. I do it in other areas too. Gosh, we might be praying or I might be talking with somebody, and I will shortcut what I actually know the Lord wants to make it a little easier or a little more enjoyable. So I'm looking at Herod and I'm thinking, I better be careful before I really condemn him. I know God is his judge, but this is something that happens to me. The trial before Pilate, gosh, he's the easiest to identify with. This poor schmuck is just, he's just scared to death. All he wants is a good employee review. He knows the right thing to do though, and he's motivated by fear. He's making his choices based on fear of loss, on fear of losing something that he values. His verdict was innocent. He knew exactly what was going on. But he caves in when the pressure mounts. Whatever happens to Jesus, I'll get that good report back in Rome. So it's okay. And he really throws Jesus under the bus, basically. I'd love to tell you I never do this. I really would. But remember we were talking earlier about being ambushed in a situation? I'll find myself, you know, say I go to a faculty meeting at some university or something and I'm surrounded by all these sophisticated academic guys and we're talking about, well, yeah, but I know you're a pastor, but how do you really feel about that creative, intelligent design stuff, you know? Listen, I am really tempted sometimes to cave in and to, if not deny Jesus, to really find a way around it that's not so embarrassing. You guys, all these trials that Jesus was subjected to, the tests that these unbelieving, really rotten, scummy guys put him to, these are things that happen to you and me. And it's really easy for us to arrive at the wrong verdict and to test him with the wrong motives. So when we go out of here, I hope it is with the understanding that we have access to a method of walking through these temptations a lot more successfully than these unbelieving pagans and Jews did. We have the ability to do this correctly. One, I would say, make sure that your motive is right. Have the right motive. If you find yourself compelled to test Jesus, to try him, whatever trial happens, maybe you're in a tough situation, you're having trouble, and you're needing Jesus to come through, you're going to find yourself trying him and testing him. The song that we sang, the last song that we sang, I only got part of it, how I have proved him o'er and o'er. That was those are good words, but the word there is very akin to testing. I trust him because I've put him to the test 1,000 times. So we're going to do that. I just want to make sure you do it in faith. Do it with love. Paul says in Romans 14, whatever we do, that whatever we decide that isn't in faith, that's sin. Whatever you decide, without faith, without love, it's going to be sin. So when you do put him to the test, boy, do it with loving faith. Have the right motive. And for goodness sake, arrive at the right verdict. Okay, you know he's not guilty, and you know you're not going to come back neutral. The only verdict that makes any sense at all, ever, under any circumstance. He's not just innocent, you guys. He's right. He's pure. That's the starting point. That's the place to take your bearings from. He's innocent. He's right. The verdict is completely, Jesus is righteous. Okay, where does that put me in relation to his position? Well, I get credit for that too if I put my faith in him. But it just helps you, if you think Jesus has let you down, if you think he's hurt you, if you think he's punished you, if you think he's been unfair with you, please arrive at the right verdict. Just understand that verdict, that's just garbage. And Satan is the one putting it in your heart. So if you have the right motive, if you test him with the right motive, and you arrive at the right verdict, you know, the easy way to do these things is to make sure you have the right judge. Know who judges you. It's Jesus. And what has he said? There's no condemnation. If you're in me, you not only have the forgiveness, you have all my righteousness. When God looks at you, when he picks your file out of the drawer and he reads the name tag on it, it says Jesus. And all those billions and billions and billions of heavenly dollars worth of credit are in your account. You couldn't bounce a check if you had to. It's good news. Remember who your judge is. Remember, he is the one, the high priest, who is able to sympathize with our weaknesses, having been tested in all of the things we have been, yet without sin. We can approach the throne of grace with confidence, not because of anything we did, not because we're any good at it, but because of who he is and because of the price he paid. Next week, we will probably get into the crucifixion itself. And through this, as hard as these lessons are, please try to keep in your mind and your heart the awareness of what they have done for us. And what a huge lesson it is that what looks like a cosmic train wreck is actually our ticket to eternal paradise. He doesn't see things the way we do. And if we remember that, then we've got the right judge. Heavenly Father, Lord, I wish we were better at this. I certainly wish I was better at it. But I lift every single one of my brothers and sisters to you, especially those here who have come after a full day to study your word in this place. Lord, please grant that these lessons will stay in our hearts, that when the enemy places temptations before us and tries our faith and sifts us, that we will remember, Lord, that you alone are worthy, that all of our faith is well placed in you, that our trust of you is rational and good and deserved, that you are righteous, holy, and innocent, and that by holding on to you, we receive a gift we could never have earned. Father, please bless us and grant that your Spirit would continue molding us until we stand before you in perfect likeness of your Son. We love you and trust you alone to accomplish this miracle. And it's in his name we thank you and ask your blessing. Amen.